Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest episode, the latest exciting chapter, the latest events on life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, Mike Parry, of course, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, how are you? And let me just remind you, before you answer that question, that as we are recording, it is just after International Women's Day. So I hope you have applauded yourself for your lifetime achievements on this special day.
Well, that's very sweet of you to say. I have a bit of a problem with International Women's Day, I have to say. Well, it shouldn't still be a thing, should it? It's a bit like my son said to me yesterday on the day, he said, you know, there isn't such a thing as International Men's Day. Yeah. And I said, well, no, you know, we're in the 21st century. Yeah. There ought not to be this discussion any further. But on the other hand, that's all very well for us to say in the first world. We ought to be focusing on the issues in the third world, in which women are not equal in such countries and don't have equal opportunities and so on. And we ought to be pouring a bit of attention and limelight throwing and effort in their direction rather than patting ourselves on the back for our achievements here.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with everything you've said. People like Lady Brady, Karen Brady, who's vice chairman of West Ham Football Club, I think she's done amazing things to improve the role of women in football, in business, in recognition of success and all that kind of stuff, you know. And she's very much of the same view. You know, I've had discussions with Karen about this. She just got on with it. She now lives in a £10 million house in Belgravia and says that, you know, when you start distinguishing between the efforts of men and women, it's almost as if you've got to make allowances for women's achievements because they're a woman. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's not appropriate, especially not in 2021.
I agree. I don't know why they had it. I can't believe it.
It's all a bit smug, and it's not my cup of tea. Every day is a day of something or other, isn't it, as well? Yeah. You know, you get Cousins Day, somebody was on about last week, and I thought, what? Cousins Day? It's, I don't know, Mothering Sunday seems to have started this whole thing, because the next thing we have Father's Day, and then we have Grandparents Day, and then we have this Sister's Day and whatever else.
Oh, it's bollocks.
And you think, actually the whole Mothering Sunday thing began with the church when many young women worked away from home and were only allowed to go home and see their mothers once a year. That's what Mothering Sunday was all about. Right. It was about going home and visiting one's own mother.
Yeah.
And of course that got hijacked, especially by commercial greetings cards makers, that kind of thing. And so suddenly everybody jumps on the bandwagon, and then there's a day for everything.
Yeah, look, there is.
We can't pause our lives to celebrate a day about everything every single day. We'd never get any work done.
No, I agree. People send each other cards on the birthdays of their pets and happy baby birthdays day. So they don't send a card to the child because the child's too young. What child's 1 year old? Send it to the parents as well. A lot of it's about the commerciality of cards, which is a business which has made a lot of people very wealthy. But I agree with you. When you see these women who are always banging the drum for equality and then demanding that everybody recognise International Women's Day, I agree with you. It's a completely inverse argument. You know what? We want equality, but we want a special day for ourselves. Anyway, look, enough of that. It's a very serious subject I want to talk to you about, Leslie Ann. We talk about all sorts of things on this podcast, but we have already, on the previous two podcasts, addressed the situation regarding Roy Greenslade, former Fleet Street editor, who came out in a huge spread in the Sunday Times and the British Journalism Review to reveal that he's been a lifelong sympathiser of the IRA, including the right of the terrorists to engage in armed struggle, meaning people got killed. And we have suddenly discovered, although I knew already but hadn't brought it up with you, that we have a personal interest in this because of a former Fleet Street colleague, don't we?
Yes, and also Roy was my boss on the Sun.
We've covered that about him coming around to your flat all the time.
We did.
Very, very strange behaviour. But what we're going to talk about now is Philip Geddes.
Yeah, so he was a young man killed outside Harrods, and I think he was a colleague of yours, wasn't he?
Well, now, I saw a letter in the Sunday Times, the last edition of the Sunday Times, and I read it with interest because it talked about Phil Geddes, and then got to the bottom of the letter, and it was signed by a chap called Garth Pearce, from somewhere in Kent or Buckinghamshire or somewhere like that, somewhere in the home counties, you happen to know Garth very well, don't you?
Yeah, I worked with Garth a lot over the years. Good guy, actually. Well-respected journalist in his day.
I totally agree. What his letter said was, he said that he'd read with fascination the two-page spread on Roy Greenslade, the editor we're talking about, and that he will never be able to forgive those who killed Philip Geddes, because at the Daily Express, where I worked with Garth Pearce, Philip Geddes, 24-year-old Oxford graduate, trying to make his way in journalism, sat at the desk next to Garth. And I remember going round there on a number of occasions and talking to Philip, who was a terrifically energetic and ambitious young man. He'd got his degree at Oxford. Do you know what the background to this story is? It's so heartbreaking. Philip Geddes was the only son of a couple who were immigrant Polish tailors who came to this country and settled in Barrow-in-Furness. Barrow-in-Furness is just about one of the most remote towns in this country. It's on that peninsula in Cumbria, you know, which is so remote. That's why they build submarines there. And I had to go there once when Chester were playing a football match there when I worked on the Chester Chronicle. And it's like driving to the end of the earth, honestly. So for Philip Geddes to have come from the local grammar school there and got to Oxford and got himself a degree when his parents fled to this country from Eastern Europe and set up a tailoring business. His father was a tailor. Can you imagine the pride those parents must have had in their boy? First of all, getting through Oxford University and then starting to work for a national newspaper. And can you imagine the horrible, dreadful shock that must have descended upon them when a policeman in the Cumbrian force knocked on their door one Saturday night?
No, just unthinkable. Absolutely unthinkable. And Greenslade, I'm afraid, has Phil Geddes' blood on his hands.
He does.
A lot of people have been asking, why would he do this kind of thing now? Yeah. Why would he come out as a supporter of terrorists? Somebody said to me over the weekend that he certainly had some sort of cancer 2 or 3 years ago. He had surgery for it.
Right.
So now there's a rumour that he's terminally ill and that this is, hence this sort of mea culpa over the IRA.
Yeah.
Now, we must be clear. In the US, he'd be arrested over this.
Yes.
Because it smacks of treason against the state, not because of his own views per se, but because he could have been feeding the provost a lot of stuff on public opinion. For example, which editor could be bamboozled, the state of play with the UK government vis-a-vis the peace talks. So in a way, Roy Greenslade was a confessed agent, except that the IRA is not a state, of course.
No.
So, you know, anyone, if someone close to me, and you've just talked about Phil, who was close to you, had been killed by an IRA bomb, I'd be very tempted to seek out Mr. Greenslade and at the very least sink my fist into his face.
Yeah, or my foot into his bollocks, actually.
Because this isn't pre-1921 Ireland with the nation fighting to be free of the hated British and all that.
Yeah.
This was a very complicated situation, okay, in which the gangster provost, and they were gangsters.
Oh, yeah.
Were murdering anyone who didn't agree with them. And he supported that. Well, shame on him.
No, I totally agree. When I say I used to go around and see Phil, he was such an energetic young fella. And I was the news editor. And if I was having a slow day and I needed a good page three story, I used to go around and say, hey, Phil, how are you doing? You know, and he wrote for the William Hickey page, OK? And I said, come on, Phil, give me a story. And I need a story for page three. And he would always try and help out. The reason he got killed was he was shopping in the West End with a lady. And there was suddenly a police alert, the police cars all over the place. And he said to her, hang on, I'll have a look at this. He had the natural instincts of a journalist, the natural instincts of a young reporter who wanted to see what was going on. And he went towards where the police were heading. And it was a door of Harrods where the bomb blew up and blew him, literally blew him to pieces, right? You know, you can't forget things like that. Hmm?
No, you really can't. Yeah. You really can't. And whatever guilt and shame Greenslade is carrying around, you know, he does have that young man's blood on his hands for the rest of his life.
Absolutely. Don't worry about the noise in the background, Miss Jones. It's just my PA unit. If you can hear any noise in the background.
While you're recording this, are you?
No, don't worry about that. Now then, Miss Jones, that's a very tragic story, but it's a very poignant story and it's very relevant. You might be right about Greenslade. I didn't know that he would have been arrested had this been in America, because, of course, I worked in America and I know the laws of sedition there. I didn't realise they extended to the IRA because, of course, there's so much sympathy for the IRA in America and I had to fight a lot of that. A lot of the time, you know, you'd go into bars in parts of New York, sometimes in Boston, even on the West Coast, and you know, some drunk would say, I got something to say to you Brits. You Brits, get the fuck out of Ireland. They'd say things like, get those tanks off those lawns in Dublin. I mean, they didn't understand the first thing about it. You know what I mean?
No, they didn't. But, I mean, look at the fervour of the St. Patrick's Day parade over there. You must have attended that a few times, as I did.
Yeah.
And they were pouring money into Ireland, weren't they, at one point?
All the time. They used to have what was called cabbage and bacon parties, where you'd go into these pubs, right, you know, on the east side of New York, and all the Irish songs were singing, and people were walking around in buckets, and you were throwing dollars into the buckets, you know, and it was all, oh, you know, it's to help the families of the oppressed men in the H camps, in the H blocks, you know, Loncash and all that. It wasn't. Mm-hmm. It was to buy arms. But anyway, look, enough of that. That's all too depressing, I'm afraid. What did you think when you saw Louise Redknapp talk about the pain of divorce? And, you know, we've had a chat about Louise before and she's got to reposition herself in life. But one of the points she made, and I'm sure this must have happened to you, it certainly happened to me from another point of view, is that when there's a divorce and people split up, loyalties towards each side of the marriage and friends are all confused, don't they?
Yeah, they are. And this sort of hardened my heart when I went through this experience, because virtually all my friends shrank away from me. When you're of a certain age, which she is, she's in her 40s with teenage children, life is all about couples and families. And if you don't fit into the mold, if you're not a pair at the dinner party table, suddenly you become persona non grata. People stop inviting you. And what I found when I was newly divorced, I carried on my place in the dinner party circuit. Mm-hmm. And I was still having my dinner parties on a Saturday night for 12 people, so six couples. I had a beautiful sort of oak table, seated 12, purpose built, cost me a fortune. And these people were still coming round to my house to partake of my dinner parties, but nobody was inviting me back. And gradually the penny dropped and I realized this was going on. And I thought, okay, they will all be justifying this and saying to themselves, oh, well, we've seen Leslie Ann, you know, we don't have to bother inviting her. What it was really about was the fact that I was single. I was on my own and I didn't fit the mold. And there's a very sexist angle to this, because a single man, people will say, oh, well, he's out there on his own as well. But a single man is like gold dust, especially a single man of a certain age. So women hostesses always want a single man at their table. Yeah. He's somebody she can flirt with. He's somebody she can show off. Oh, you know, my wonderful friend so-and-so, he's the most eligible bachelor on the block, you know.
Yeah, sure.
But so he's not an embarrassment, whereas a single woman is. So Jamie Redknapp will have been having a whale of a time, being invited left, right and centre, while Louise is sitting at home wondering where all her friends have gone. And I know exactly how this feels because I've been there.
It sounds horrible. But when you got married, you know, and that's a completely different story. I mean, you are far more with the in crowd than whoever your husband was, because you were already a celebrity rock chick writer. So I can't understand how your friends could have drifted off onto his side and not, you know, came around and started to make sure that you were okay.
Oh, well, you're missing the point, because I left that world to marry him and to have children.
Okay.
So I was no longer in that celebrity world. Okay. I left behind all that world and walked away from it, walked away from Fleet Street, everything, to become a wife and mother.
Right.
So the friends we made...
We're all here.
No. You make friends when your children go to school.
Course,
so they go to school from about the age of three. They start at nursery and so on.
Yeah.
And you start to socialise with other couples, parents, and you start to go to each other's houses, drinks, parties, all of that, and your social life becomes more or less exclusively other parents from your children's schools. So you make those friends together.
No,
Are the couples who no longer want you around when you're a single woman.
Well, when you kept hosting these dinner parties and you said there were 12 of you, who was your partner then?
Well, no, I didn't have one. I was by myself.
So was it 11 or 13 then?
11.
11, God.
They were perfectly happy at the beginning to carry on around to me, but they didn't want to invite me back. Yeah. And so the whole thing dried up pretty soon because I wasn't going to keep inviting people who no longer invited me back.
No, over the years, though, didn't a lot of your female friends go through the same horrible experience as you and broken up marriage?
No. It's interesting. I think that there is a classist thing to divorce, frankly.
Right.
Middle class people tend not to divorce very much because they've got too much to lose.
Right.
So at either end of the social scale, where you've got very working class people, honourable working class people with not very much, they tend to divorce quite easily or to separate quite easily because there isn't much to lose. Aristocratic people can divorce because they can afford to. Whereas in the middle, you've got people with, say, a nice family home. They might even have a holiday home or a second home somewhere. They've got the cars, they've got the kids, the schools, everything else, all the trappings of their lifestyle, which when you chop that in half, leaves not very much if there is half to get. There wasn't even in my case even half to get. But so I know quite a lot of people who've stuck with their marriages. In many cases, quite unsatisfactorily, they're not really very happy, but they go through the motions because they don't want to lose the lifestyle. I could name you 15, 20 people off the top of my head who are living like that today. And I've got to say that I'm glad that I'm not living like that.
Well, as long as you're happy within yourself. Just to get back to the point you made about a single man, right, I actually went through that experience. Because I worked at the Daily Express with Philippa Kennedy. Do you know Philippa?
Very well.
Right. So I worked with her on the news desk. Philippa was the news editor for a while, and I was her deputy. And then Philippa went and became feature suprema. So I became the news editor, but I was a single man. And Philippa valued me greatly for the role you've just been talking about. You know what I mean? Oh, the single man at the dinner party. And I thought it must have just been my unique, you know, charm and attraction, all that. I didn't realise I was quite a valuable asset to making the numbers add up.
Well, it was obviously both in your case. You know, your,
thank you. That's very kind
of you. Witty back chat and your very elegant company, you know, and your erudite conversation, all of those things.
Yes.
But of course, also big plus, single bloke.
Mm. Yeah, well, that's very interesting. So there we are. Talking about blokes, Ms. Jones, did you ever have any dealings with Eddie Grant?
Yeah. I like Eddie Grant a lot. He's a good musician, nice man as well.
This is great because here, I'll give you a rendition. Hang on, what is it? We're romancing the stone. Da 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 da. Now, that should have been the opening song to the very famous film that Michael Douglas made with that famous actress called...
That's so famous that you can't remember her name. Kathleen Turner.
For that great film, Romancing the Stone. Have you seen it, Romancing the Stone?
Yeah, a long time ago. That was in 1984 or something.
I just love it. She is a fantastic comic actress. Michael Douglas was, the sort of pin-up boy and all that. Basically, the plot is that she rushes off to try and rescue her sister in some godforsaken hellhole in Colombia, runs into Michael Douglas. They come across a huge diamond. They've got to fight their way out to get it. It's brilliant. But the amazing thing was Eddie Grant wrote the theme tune for Romancing the Stone. It fell out with Michael Douglas. It never got used. But Romancing the Stone got to number one as an individual record, but it wasn't attached to the film.
Well, that's absolutely bollocks, if you don't mind my French.
I
don't know where you got this story from.
What?
Now, it's not true that he wrote it for the film, okay? He wrote the song, Romancing the Stone, for his 1984 album, Going for Broke.
Yes. So how come the film was called Romancing the Stone then?
Hang on, let me finish. The song was going to be used for the feature film as its theme. But in the end, they decided only to use it briefly in the film. So clips from the film appear in some of the official music videos for that song. And the song is mentioned in the film's closing credits. So it is part of it.
Yeah.
But it isn't that it was dumped because it's in the film.
Well, okay, why wasn't it used as the opening song, like, you know, like a James Bond, you know, Thunderball or Goldfinger or something? Why was it only used in passing?
Because it's not a theme song. It, you know, whether he was wrongly briefed or whatever. But actually, it's not a theme song of a movie. It's a great album track, yeah. And it was a hit, and probably was helped by the fact that it was part of the film. It was in the film. It just wasn't the theme tune to the film.
And did you do a lot of stuff with Eddie?
Well, not that kind of stuff.
No. You said that you know him quite well. I mean, have you written lots of pieces on him and all that kind
of
stuff?
Well, I did.
Honestly, Miss Jones, sometimes you're double entendres, you know?
No, you. It was a leading question. Come on. Eddie's quite a lot older than me, actually. I think you thought he was 55.
I think he's 75.
No, he's 73, actually.
Oh, he's 73, yeah, okay.
Yeah. But, I mean, look, great hits. Do you remember Electric Avenue? What a great hit that was.
Electric Avenue. Whenever I drive home back through Brixton, there's an Electric Avenue in Brixton.
That's what it's named after, that
You're
exact
joking.
Electric Avenue.
You're joking.
No. And then there was another great hit called Gimme Hope, Joanna, which was a big anti-apartheid message song and so on.
Yeah.
Last heard of performing at Glastonbury in 2008.
Who was?
Eddie Grant.
Well, what's happened to him since then?
Oh, he's still making music. But, I mean, I think people tend to forget that Eddie was one of the founders of the Equals. Do you remember the Equals? They were one of the UK's first integrated pop groups.
Hang on, I've got...
Very important.
I've got one in my head. Baby, 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 bring me back. Da, da, baby, baby. Is that an Equals song?
Yeah, it might be.
Yeah, it might be.
It's difficult to tell from the way you sing it.
I've got one. I bet this is true. Black skin, blue eyed boy, ain't gonna dance no more, ain't gonna fight no more. Was that the Equals? I think it might well be. Black skin, blue eyed boy, ain't gonna fight no more. I think it was from my youth. Yeah, yeah.
But do you know what? If you say to most people, certainly my kids, if I said to them, you know, tell me what do you know about the Equals, they would go, who?
Yes, no, I know they would. Yeah, well, I'm afraid.
Shame, isn't it? It's because they were really important, really groundbreaking band.
Yes, no, I totally agree. Now, Ms. Jones, if you went into your local supermarket today, as often you do, obviously, and your potatoes were encrusted with soil. Right.
Is that a euphemism?
No.
How are your potatoes today? Encrusted with soil, darling.
But it's absolutely true. Listen to this. Tesco is selling muddy spuds for the first time since the 1970s in a bid to cut food waste. The supermarket giant says leaving the soil on helps block out light and more than doubles the shelf life of a potato. I think this is wonderful, don't you?
Well, I do remember when I was a child that the potatoes we bought, because we didn't have supermarkets in those days, the potatoes we got were always covered in mud and you had to wash them.
Yes, that's right. That's what I remember as well. But I loved the mud, if you see what I mean, because it made it look like, you know, this food is from the earth. Whereas, funny enough, only yesterday I bought a bag of what are called baby potatoes, you know what I mean, small ones, in a sealed plastic bag. And they're all terribly clean, you know what I mean? And then, and I remember those old potatoes. When I saw this story this morning, I thought, it takes me back to my youth. Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. It's myself and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire. I couldn't get that out there. Miss Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, of your generation, which I'm talking about Eddie Grant, but, you know, we do like to... expand into our lives in journalism and you into the world of pop. Gary Newman is 63. I'm sure I've got that right. He only ever made one record, didn't he, called Cars?
Yeah, no, he's had an illustrious career, has Gary. But a sort of cult following, really. I was at an awards dinner, lunch, I should say, summer before last, and he picked up a Lifetime Achievement Award. It was the Nordoff Robbins, you know, the music therapy charity.
Yes.
And he's such a nice guy. He was there in all his black eye makeup and so on. I found something so interesting about Gary.
Yeah.
It was the fact that he married his stalker. Do you remember that?
No, I don't. I tell you who did marry her stalker, and that was Annifrid from ABBA. She married her stalker. Do you remember?
Yes, vaguely, yeah.
What do you mean vaguely? She's one of the most beautiful women who's ever picked up a microphone and sung a song in one of the world's most successful ever groups.
Don't split hairs. It's not that I don't remember who she is, but I don't really remember the stalker bit.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, so go on.
I certainly remember it about Gary. Yes, there was a woman or a girl who used to stalk him around and, you know, make his life hell. And in the end, he got to know her and they got married.
I find that weird. I find that weird beyond comprehension.
So do I. Yes, because somebody who's capable of that kind of behaviour. You know, if say for example, if you stalked me, if you kept turning up outside my house.
No, I won't be honest, like, I promise.
Pushing notes through the door and all that kind of thing. No. I'd think you were a weirdo.
Yeah, but Miss Jones, I promise you I won't stalk. I won't put notes through your door because you might not come for lunch with me again, you know, and I do so enjoy talking to you about the Beatles. talking about the Beatles, by the way, I mean, look, I'm sorry if anybody who listens to this podcast thinks, oh, it's another Beatles story, but we have to give you one in every podcast because...
Beg your pardon?
yeah, sorry about this. Oh, dear me, there's no stopping you, is there? Here, how about this? The Fab Four faked each other's signatures. Beatles memorabilia worth millions may have its value slashed after it was revealed they used to fake each other's autographs. I thought everybody knew that.
Everybody does that. I can remember being on tour with Queen once.
Oh, yes.
And, in fact, it wasn't even the rest of the band. It was the roadies. We're all sitting around signing the merchandise.
You're joking.
No, everybody's done that. Nobody could reasonably expect that a band member, especially somebody like Mick Jagger or, you know, John Lennon, could sit there day after day, night after night, signing hundreds of thousands of items of merchandise.
Yeah.
It just wouldn't work.
No, I totally agree. I don't think I'm telling any secrets here, but David Beckham's sister, who ran his fan club, so to speak, you know what I mean? She had to enlist people to do that because otherwise it would have been impossible. He had millions of requests. And funny enough, go on.
What I've always thought weird as well was, why would you think that having something signed in ink by the person, even though we know 9 times out of 10 it's not going to be signed by them, unless you see them sign the thing themselves right in front of your eyes, why would you think that thing was more valuable because they'd written on it?
Well, because it is endorsed by them, if you see what I mean. I've got a David Beckham signed shirt, okay? It's an international shirt.
Signed by his sister, you mean?
well, no, you see, I had an advantage here because I used to work at the FA, right? In one of my arrest periods during my journalistic career, I went and worked for the Football Association for 15 months as a terrific head of communications, right? Handled all the crises that came along, Bruce Grobbelaar, Paul Merson, and all that, with absolute...
Oh, you had some great stories, didn't you, during your time?
Oh, absolutely amazing while I was there. But then, you know, I was desperate to get back into journalism because I felt like I'd turn, you know, the poacher had turned gamekeeper, and I was just so uncomfortable about it. And anyway, the FA decided it was time for me to go because I was giving too many stories away, you know, because I used to meet my mates on a Friday night and tell them everything that was going on. They'd all appear in the papers on Sunday, Monday mornings. And I said, well, you know, as far as I'm concerned, why keep it secret? Anyway, well, that's another story. Point is, I got an opportunity to buy the Dave Beckham shirt, and then I was able to get an expert from Union Camp to examine it, and it is a genuine David Beckham autograph.
Interesting.
I feel pretty good about it. But this is the other one. You've been up to Liverpool and you've seen Paul McCartney at the institute that he's founded and all that. But I read something to say that the works of John Lennon is now going to be offered as a master's degree. At some, I can't remember where it is now, some university.
Liverpool University, yeah, but they've been run. Yes, you can do a degree in the Beatles there. Yeah. You've been able to do that for some years.
Oh, right. Okay.
So that's not a new thing, but I think they are adding, what they've added is a master's degree in the life and work of, you know. Master's degree is obviously a step up from your usual BA honours degree would normally do between the age of 18 and 21.
I see. But the funniest thing that I saw, I like to think that I'm a bit of a Beatles expert. Not like you are, of course, because you've written the definitive John Lennon book, you know, and researched it immaculately. But I've tried to keep up, you know, over the years, reading all the books and that kind of stuff. And I see a great story is that when John Lennon was 15, his teacher at school said, you'll never amount to anything. 10 years later, the same teacher at school was asking the pupils in the class to interpret John Lennon lyrics because they were so deep and meaningful. And that apparently is why he wrote I Am the Walrus with such complicated lyrics. And he actually said to somebody when he was doing it, right, let's see if the fuckers can work this one out. And the line he was talking, excuse my language, by the way, listeners. And the line he was talking about was Salamina Pilchard climbing up the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah, I did a whole sort of breakdown of those lyrics in the the sort of appendix of my book.
That's where I got it all from. Yeah.
A lot of it was just phrases plucked out of thin air. Things that, you know, certainly in English culture at that time, in the late 50s, early to mid 60s, that things which were commonly referred to, but which outside of the British Isles meant nothing at all.
No.
And people would pore over those lyrics for years, trying to fathom what on earth they were about. But of course, a lot of his whole thing, John's strength was slogans, wasn't it? He'd have made a great advertising copywriter because he was great at coming up with slogans.
Yeah.
But really just juxtaposing uncomfortable words. And it's always all about rhythm and sound. That's what lyrics really are about, making the most of the sound and the rhythm of words.
Yeah. Well, no, you're absolutely right. And as you said in your book, of course, once he became bored being a pop star, he became an international peace campaigner, didn't he? And then, you know, moved on to anything else he wanted to do. And you're so right. Just bring me another slogan. So, for instance, let's sit in bed in, was it Montreal? Give peace a chance. I mean, it was brilliant, wasn't it?
Well, that started in Amsterdam, of course.
Amsterdam,
and then they they moved their peace campaign around the world. So, yes, they were in Canada. And that mainly happened because they weren't able to get into the United States at that point.
Yes.
So they went to Canada instead.
Yeah, I accept that. Now, have you ever had a fear you might have had diabetes, or have you been tested for it?
I have been tested for it. Fortunately, I'm not a sufferer at this point in my life.
Why did you get tested for it?
I can't remember now. It might have been one of those well woman checks or something.
Yeah, something like that. Oh, yeah. I found out I had diabetes 2, which is obviously the less dangerous of the two, when a couple of summers ago I was waking up in the middle of the night and so thirsty, you couldn't believe it. And I would rush to the fridge and I could drink a litre of Dr. Peppers. You know what I mean? I mean, I had to, you know, just to satisfy something in my body. But the strange thing is, the more when you've got diabetes at that stage, the more you take in, the more weight you lose. You start losing weight very rapidly. I don't know why. It's some sort of medical process that happens in your body. Anyway, I thought something's wrong here, you know. So I went to the doctor and he said, yes, you've got a huge diabetes 2 problem. You've got glucose readings, which are off the scale. Get it sorted and we'll give you some medication, all that kind of stuff. But I found the easiest way to beat diabetes 2, which I've now beaten, by the way. I could still have it if I didn't obey my own rules on eat and drink, but I've more or less got rid of it. Is just cut down enormously on your sugar and your carbohydrates, okay? So I can't understand why almost every week now I read in a newspaper the diabetes diet, beat diabetes with this diet. It's all complete bollocks, to use an expression you used earlier in this podcast, Miss Jones.
I got it from you,
Yes, that's right, yeah. Because
I don't even know what it means.
Because I think it's a contrick. I think it's a blinking contrick to start telling people the diabetes diet, you get rid of it. It's bollocks. It's like losing weight. If you want to lose weight, eat less and drink less alcohol. If you want to get rid of diabetes, eat less, lose weight, and don't take sugar into your body. Give up the packets of wine gums I used to eat. You know, give up the old angel cake that I used to love eating. The Battenberg. I used to love the Battenberg, particularly the marzipan around the outside. I could eat two in a night watching Coronation Street, you know? What are you going to do?
What, two whole cakes?
Yeah, honestly, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. No wonder you were sick. But, but what I don't get is you can't have diabetes and have beaten it.
Yeah, well, it's in remission, if that's the, for want of a better word. You know what I mean? I mean, I don't have diabetes now. My doctor told me. He said, Mike, you've got rid of it. Your levels are down to, I don't know, something like 44 or something like that. They'd started at 173 or something like that. And to all intents and purposes, it had gone.
Oh, well, that's, I mean, brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, if you were rushing to the fridge to down the litres of Dr. Peppers,
yes,
that is pure sugar, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah, absolutely. I just desperately needed it, you know, for some. But I've had a sweet tooth all my life. I could get into my car in Surrey on a four and a half hour drive up to Liverpool to watch Everton. And I'd go and stay at the Crown Plaza, the night before the game, something like that, you know. And during that car, I'd stop to get petrol. When I got petrol, I'd get one of these big sort of family bags of Maltesers, a big family bag of wine gums, and a big family bag of licorice all sorts. And they were all gone by the time I got to Liverpool. I had such a sweet tooth, you couldn't believe it.
But that's not really to do with having a sweet tooth. That's to do with the habit of cramming stuff into your mouth because you're bored. So sitting there on a long car journey, I think it is.
No, I think just love to taste.
Nobody needs to cram their mouth with stuff while they're driving somewhere. That's just a habit that you can very easily break. Because that's not hunger. You're not eating to satisfy your hunger cravings.
Yeah.
You don't need that fuel.
Because
you're not
sugar.
Walking there.
I need
you're
the
just
sugar.
Sitting there driving.
I'd
yeah, but to. You don't need it. That's the point.
Did you, as a kid, ever eat those tubes of refreshers? Hmm? You know the ones in the cellophane packet?
I do know the ones. Yeah, we weren't allowed sweets very often in my family. Once a term or so, we had sweets. So that sweets were a treat, but it was a bit like with my children and McDonald's. You know, some kids eat McDonald's every day or every week.
Yeah,
I would allow my children to have it once a term, so three times a year.
Yeah,
and that was, I used to say to them, this is like eating cardboard. I don't know why you want it, but I could understand because all their friends were having it. So it would become a big deal when off we would go once a term, so three times a year, and they could indulge.
Well,
but the same thing for us with sweets when I was a children.
Yeah. Well,
I had a split personality, apparently.
You must have done. Well, I think that's very responsible as a mother, because my little sister Jill is a home economist. She's brought up two children. They've done so very well in life and they're very healthy and tall. You know, Tom, my nephew, is 6'4", and Karen, my niece, is 5'10" for a lady. And she did exactly the same. She didn't want to deprive the children altogether of the, you know, the thrill of having a McDonald's or something like that, or Burger King, because other kids in school did. But she was very, very careful and always balanced their diet up with something else, as I'm sure you did. Now, Ms. Jones, getting serious again for a minute. We can't ignore the fact that since we were last recording this podcast, the great interview has happened with Oprah Winfrey, Meghan and Harry. The question I've got to ask you is, does this signal the start of the end of the British royal family, the only one that's left in the world? All the others have collapsed and disappeared because of this very sort of divisive split within the ranks.
I think it's been coming for a long time. I think this is a major nail in the coffin. What I've always hoped would be that the institution of the royal family, and it is an institution, it's a throwback, it's a dinosaur, it's a tradition that has no real place in the modern world. Yeah. It's so covert and closed shop, and it's almost mafia-like in its secrecy.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
But it doesn't really have a place in the modern world. But I hoped that it would continue for the lifetime of Her Majesty. I have no interest in Charles and Camilla. Ever since the death of Princess Diana, I've lost faith in Charles. I think he's a very self-serving, very pompous, very selfish man, and I don't think he really deserves to be our head of state. I'm not interested in William and Kate. I think they're boring. It's all about them. I think that there was a lot of affection for Harry, and especially when he met the love of his life.
Yes.
And there's no question that Meghan is the love of his life and that they are very happy together. And I think that she has blown through the monarchy like a breath of fresh air, because she's not afraid of it. She hasn't been forced into silence. She wasn't going to put up with a lot of the nonsense that the rest of them have been made to put up with all these years. And whatever our opinion of how she's behaved, and what she might have done to add to this fallout. Yeah. She has stood there and gone, do you know what? I am a private person. I had my own adult life before I met my husband. And she's almost 40 years of age, I think. She's stood there and gone, actually, do you know what? I don't have to put up with this. And not only that, but I think the world has a right to know what really goes on in there, inside that institution. So I have to say, I know it's a controversial view, that I can't help feeling some respect for Haz and Meg for coming out and saying what's really gone on.
I totally disagree with you on every aspect of that. I think she got a clause into Harry. I thought, God, I've got myself a real English prince, okay? And, I mean, according to some of the reports, she contacted Oprah Winfrey even before she'd even got married to say, look, we can arrange things here. She saw an opportunity, a massive opportunity, to cash in to become one of the most famous women in the world and one of the richest. And I think that's what her plan was from day one. And when she moved into the royal family, the idea that she was oppressed and she was bullied and she was talked down to, I mean, she did not understand what she was entering. The famous picture is almost a year ago from today, when it was the Commonwealth, Commonwealth National Day, something like that, right? It's about a year ago from you and I recording this now. And that's Harry and Meghan, were put in the second row.
That's Harry and Meghan. That is a classic quote.
Well, you know, Meghan. Well, I think Harry is now her slave. I think Harry's now just following her around, you know, and doing everything Meghan wants to do. But what I'm saying is, the picture was so telling because Prince Charles and Camilla and Prince William and Kate were in the front row, and Meghan and Harry and Prince Edward, who's a sort of no member of the royal family, and his wife, whose name I can't remember, were in the second row. And you can almost see that it suddenly dawned on her, hang on, I thought I was going to be like front of house here. I thought I would now get top of billing because I'm an ex-Hollywood actress who's come here to really lighten up and brighten up and revolutionise the British royal family. I think from the start, she was completely deluded.
Well, I disagree, but nobody can know what's in her heart and her mind. Nobody but she can tell us that. Well, I don't think she is that calculating. And I do think that she has blown a hole through this institution and that we are now realizing some unpalatable truths about our monarchy, which, after all, is part of the way our country is run. Yeah. So it does matter to us. Well, but I do think this is the beginning of the end. I don't think the monarchy has relevance going forward after the sad death of Her Majesty, whenever that will be.
Yeah, I think that is going to be a problem. I do think Prince Charles will pick it up in a big way. I think he's still got credibility. But to inherit a throne when he's going to be nearly 80 himself, that is going to be, I agree, a big problem. And you have to wonder what comes next. Talking about people with engagement or marital problems, I see that Nicolas Cage has just got married for the fifth time, not surprisingly, to a woman 31 years his junior. Is this a classic sort of case of Hollywood actor just keeps swapping wife for a younger model about every 10 years?
Well, it does look like that, doesn't it? I mean, I've never really seen the point of him, to be honest. I can't think of a single film that I've gone, Nicolas Cage is such an amazing actor.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I know very little about him. I have to sort of look him up on my phone to look at his face and see what it's all about. But that's Hollywood for you. Talking about actors who I do respect, by the way. Two David Tennant shows won prizes in the inaugural Radio Times Awards last night. The actor, 49, played Dennis Nilsson in the ITV show Des, based on the Scottish serial killer and necrophile. And Tennant's lockdown comedy, Staged, starring Michael Sheen, who I also think is brilliant, was named Best Comedy at the virtual ceremony. Those are two guys who I really, really do admire and like, Tennant and Sheen.
They are proper actors. I absolutely loved Tennant as Doctor Who.
Yeah.
I don't want to watch a drama about Dennis Nielsen because I just don't need that kind of stuff in my head, frankly. I look at entertainment from a very simplistic viewpoint, yes. which is I want to feel good. I want to feel better. I want something that is uplifting. I'd rather watch a David Attenborough wildlife program, which tells me how amazing nature is
yes.
and how uplifted I feel by seeing all these intricate bits of filming into how yeah. certain animals operate, you know, what their behavior and their environment, their habitat, all that kind of thing. I'd rather watch that yeah. than how a serial killer ate his victims. You know, I don't want to know that.
Well,
so
yeah.
I can rate David Tennant as an actor, but I sometimes feel that when the material is disturbing, they've lost me as a viewer because I don't want anything to do with that.
Oh, I love the drama. I think it's great. And I think I've told you this story before, the one about Dennis Nielsen, the serial killer. It was in Cranley Gardens in North London. Alex Hendry, a reporter on the Daily Express, came out of his house at sort of lunchtime, heading for the Daily Express office because he was on a shift starting at 2 o'clock. In those days, we had so many reporters, we had three different shifts a day. Those who started at 9, at 10, at 12, at 2. We had about six different shifts, you know, at 5, at 7, all that kind of stuff. And he was on at 2 o'clock. And as he came out of his house, there were like three or four police cars parked at the end of the road. Of course, with the natural instincts of a reporter, he went over and he said, hello, you know. And they said, oh, no, sorry, it was a suspected gas explosion. And the reason they said that was because Dino Rod had been called in to...
Who's Diana Rod?
No, Dino Rod, Miss Jones. Dino okay. Rod, Dino Ross.
Dino Rod and the Supremes, you mean?
Funny you should say that. On this day we're recording now, what are you laughing about? A few years ago, Dino Ross recorded her second ever number one, Chain Reaction. I'm going to give you now a chain reaction. I'm going to tell you there is no satisfaction, or something like that, anyway.
But something like that, yeah.
No, I'm like the lyrics. Anyway,
I do.
Go back to the story. Dino Rod been called in. Alex goes off and drives to the office. By about 5 o'clock, he's on his way back to North London with an unspecified address because they've found some serial killer who's flushed his victims down the drain. That was why Dino Rod were there, to investigate the drains. And it was six doors away from where Alec lived. So,
well, I can outdo that because I knew the couple who lived next door to Dennis Nielsen.
No.
Yeah, this couple I knew for years called Julie and Gary. They lived in the house next door. And I used to go to their house for parties.
Good
so
God.
They probably shared the drains with this serial killer.
My God, I mean, this gets worse. Listen, one last thing. On this day today in 1988, Eddie the Eagle Edwards landed home in Britain to a hero's welcome. 10,000 people lined the streets of Cheltenham to greet the 24-year-old ski-jumping loser. Why on earth could he ever become a national hero for losing so badly? I don't like losers, Miss Jones. I like people like you who are winners. Why in this country are we the only country that celebrate losers?
No, we're a country who celebrates the underdog. And there was something so wonderfully enchanting about Eddie the Eagle. I went on a trip with him because he had a single out. He had a single out called Fly Eddie Fly after he came last at the Olympics, but yeah. in such spectacular style. The world took to him.
Yeah.
He really captured the imagination, didn't he?
Yeah.
And he was number one in Finland in whatever year it was. So I had to go on the press trip with him. It was just him and me, actually, was the press trip.
Yeah.
So I covered his covering, you know, on TV, radio, doing all the interviews out there and so on. We had a whale of a time. And then years later, my friend Sean McCauley, do you remember Sean worked on the Mail on Sunday? He was a reporter there at the same time as I was there. He moved to Los Angeles to try his hand at being a screenwriter.
Yeah.
And he wrote the film, Eddie the Eagle, which starred Hugh Jackman as the fictitious trainer of Eddie. Of course, the real Eddie never had a ski trainer.
No.
He didn't have anything, poor guy.
No.
But Hugh Jackman played his trainer in that film. Wonderful film. Have you seen it?
No, I don't like films about losers, you see.
No, but he didn't come across as a loser. He came over as a winner. And Keith Allen played his dad. And his dad was very anti-Eddie ever trying to be anything in the Olympics.
Yeah.
And he tried to put him off at every stage. And the closing scene of this, when Eddie lands back at the airport, you've got to see it. It's so emotional. I cry every time.
Yeah. Really?
Really.
How do you actually practice to be a ski jumper? Because in the end, you have to sort of vault 300 feet into the air. How do you do that in grades?
Well, he got himself out into the mountains and he practiced on those very ski jumps. The first time he went down, I think it was the third grade one, you know, he'd never done a ski jump in his life. But he just had enormous self-belief. He had tremendous courage and he had determination. And those are qualities, those are traits that we really rate as Brits, I think.
Right, OK. Well, you know, I don't want to put man down when he's tried so hard, and I admire him for having done what he did, but I prefer to celebrate winners. But anyway, there we are. OK, Miss Jones, the end of another chapter of Life on Planet Porky. I've got an appointment now with a football match, OK, which I'm rather looking forward to. And I know you're very busy, so Ms. Jones, just keep looking after business. And to all our millions of listeners out there, thank you very much for having tuned in. Back with you very soon. Have you seen it? We're onto the stage.
A long time ago. That was 1984 or something.
I just love it. I just love it. She is a fantastic comic actress. Michael Douglas was, the sort of pin-up boy and all that. And basically, the plot is that she rushes off to try and rescue her sister in some godforsaken hellhole in Colombia, runs into Michael Douglas. They come across a huge diamond. They've got to fight their way out to get it. It's brilliant. But the amazing thing was, Eddie Grant wrote the theme tune to Romancing the Stone. It fell out with Michael Douglas. It never got used. But Romancing the Stone got to number one as an individual record, but it wasn't attached to the film.
Well, that's absolutely bollocks, if you don't mind my French.
I beg your pardon.
I don't know where you got this story from.
I think it's a blinking contract to start telling people the diabetes diet, you get rid of it. It's bollocks. It's like losing weight. If you want to lose weight, eat less and drink less alcohol. If you want to get rid of diabetes, eat less, lose weight, and don't take sugar into your body. Give up the packets of wine gums I used to eat. You know, give up the old angel cake that I used to love eating. The Battenberg. I used to love the Battenberg, particularly the marzipan around the outside. I could eat two in a night watching Coronation Street, you know? I'm sorry if anybody who listens to this podcast thinks, oh, it's another Beatles story, but we have to give you one in every podcast because...
Beg your pardon?
Sorry about this. Oh, dear me. There's no stopping you, is there?